The top stories, U.S. President Donald Trump says he will leave the White House if the Electoral College confirms Joe Biden as the winner of the November 3rd vote. Germany says its total number of coronavirus infections has passed 1 million as the country struggles to contain the spread of the disease. Diego Maradona is laid to rest near Argentine's capital after huge crowds turned out to pay respect to the late football legend. Welcome to the program. U.S. President Donald Trump says he will leave the White House if the Electoral College votes for his rival Joe Biden to be the winner of the disputed election.
So if the Electoral College does elect President-elect Joe Biden, are you not going to leave this building?
Just so you, certainly I will. Certainly I will. And you know that. But I think that there will be a lot of things happening between now and the 20th of January. A lot of things.
He made the comments after a Thanksgiving Day address to U.S. troops at the White House. This was the closest the U.S. president has come to conceding defeat in the November 3rd election. U.S. media declared Biden the winner of the election after projecting that he will receive 270 electoral votes required to enter the Oval Office. Trump and some of his fellow Republicans claim that the vote was rigged in favor of Biden and have filed several lawsuits to overrule the election results. The Electoral College, that is, it's due to vote on December the 14th to officially decide the outcome of the presidential vote. Journalist and commentator Max Perry believes the power struggle in the U.S. is far from over. The U.S. President Donald Trump has not yet exhausted all his options to override the election results.
In addition to this statement, he also said that a lot was going to happen in between now and January 20th. So in my view, that could mean that he may be considering other legal avenues, including possibly trying to order the state legislatures, where there's a Republican majority in both houses in these contested states, to override the popular vote and elect pro-Trump electors to the Electoral College instead. I'm not so sure myself that this power struggle is over, that all of his avenues have been exhausted, and that could mean, as I said, trying to override the popular vote and get these state legislators to appoint pro-Trump electors, or taking it to the Supreme Court, which his campaign lawyer Rudy Giuliani seems dead set on doing.
The Australian Army says 13 soldiers could face dismissal in relation to a damning report on alleged war crimes in Afghanistan.
At this time, 13 individuals have been issued administrative action notices in relation to the Afghanistan inquiry. At this point in time, no individuals have been separated from the Australian Defence Force. Administrative action includes receiving a notice proposing to terminate the individual's service. The individual then has the opportunity to respond within a minimum of 14 days. The decision maker must...
The Australian Army Chief said each matter and individual circumstance will be considered on a case-by-case basis. The move to discharge the soldiers follows a last week report on a years-long investigation. It said Australia's elite special forces unlawfully killed 39 Afghan civilians and prisoners. The victims included those killed by summary execution. The report recommended 19 individuals be referred to Australian Federal Police. It also recommended that compensation is paid to the families of the victims. Canberra apologized to Kabul over the alleged war crimes. Now, the alleged war crimes by the Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan have caused outrage there. People and rights groups have demanded perpetrators be brought to justice. Amin Alami is in Kabul.
Not only Australian forces, but others will kill us if we continue to ignore each other's will. This is clear that they provided some specific figures with dollars and heavy vehicles while our people are trampled.
It's quite clear that the responsible Australian forces must be prosecuted, and their prosecution process must be widely covered by media outlets to advocate victims' rights.
We want the ICC as a responsible body in this regard to seriously investigate the killing of civilians by Australian forces and punish them.
Killing of civilians is not in line with no law and logic. So the government and international body need to strongly back the rights of the victims and bring the accountable figures to justice.
Those Australian forces who have killed innocent civilians in Oruzgan must be punished. They have claimed to support us, instead they kill us. So the government and international rights bodies must properly investigate the case.
The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees announces that it is hit by an unprecedented financial crisis.
For the first time in the history of the agency, we have no cash available anymore to cover our spending between now and the end of the year.
Philippe Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, says the agency has received the lowest level of contribution since 2012. This is while the coronavirus pandemic is exacerbating the needs of the refugees. The agency relies on funds from UN member states and the European Union. But its finances have been ravaged by a U.S. decision to slash hundreds of millions of dollars of aid. Lazzarini also warns that the health system in Gaza is about to collapse due to the coronavirus pandemic. Gaza, which has been under an Israeli enforced blockade since 2007, is experiencing a deteriorating economic situation. Political commentator Zafar Bangai says U.S. projected winner by media account Joe Biden is unlikely to help UNRWA deal with its severe financial crisis, as he has proven to be a believing Zionist.
The Palestinians are now basically being abandoned, and they're being told that unless and until they accept the demands that the Trump regime had imposed, as well as the Netanyahu regime had imposed, that unless and until these Palestinians accept those demands, that they're going to be abandoned completely and they're going to starve in the refugee camps. So this is the stark situation that the Palestinian people face at the present time. And so what Joe Biden is going to do, we really don't know. I think we shouldn't hold too much hope, because Joe Biden is on record as stating that he is a Zionist, and he has said that if Israel did not exist, that America would have had to invent it or create it. So I think it would be unrealistic to hold too much hope that Joe Biden is going to take any steps that is somehow going to, he's going to do something that would benefit or help the Palestinian people.
A new UN report says the cumulative economic cost of the Israeli occupation only from the prolonged closure and military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018 is estimated at more than $16 billion. Ashraf Shannon has more.
The UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said in a report that Israel's prolonged blockade of the Gaza Strip and the regime's military operations against the Palestinian enclave had inflicted some $17 billion U.S. dollars in losses between 2007 and 2018. Richard Kuzel-Wright, the director of UNCTAD's Globalization and Development Strategies, said that it was extremely difficult to see anything but de-development being the fate of Gaza society. The Israeli regime has placed the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007 and waged three wars on it since 2008. The blockade and military operations had driven the poverty rate in Gaza to increase almost fourfold compared with normal conditions.
The losses that were highlighted in the UNCTAD report show the extent of damage caused by the Israeli blockade and wars against the Gaza Strip, especially the three major wars since 2008. Israel has systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure and economic sectors, in addition to the loss of innocent lives.
According to the UNCTAD report, Gaza has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. In addition to killing and maiming thousands of Gazans during the wars, Israeli forces also bombed civilian infrastructure, as well as thousands of factories and businesses.
The Palestinian economy in Gaza is collapsing because of the Israeli wars and blockade. Israel waged three major wars in less than 10 years and destroyed all aspects of our economy in Gaza.
As day laborers, we sustained heavy losses because of the wars. Factories were destroyed during the wars, and thousands of people lost their sources of income.
UNCTAD says its estimates are partial because they cover only the economic cost of the Israeli occupation from the prolonged closure and recurrent military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018. Experts say the Israeli regime must be held accountable for its illegal policies against the Palestinian people.
Israeli military aggressions and the blockade amount to war crimes, and the international community must bring an end to Israel's impunity. The Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations must also include the economic file in their complaints at the International Criminal Court because Israel perpetrated war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Observers say that for Gaza's economy to slightly recover, the blockade must be fully lifted.
According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's regional economy and its isolation from the Palestinian economy and the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As of the COVID-19 now, Germany's total confirmed coronavirus infections has passed 1 million as the country is struggling to curb the second wave of the outbreak. Cases jumped after the Robert Koch Institute on Friday reported more than 22,000 new infections. Germany has been reporting hundreds of daily deaths in the past few days. Its total COVID fatalities are now nearing 15,600. The virus has been surging despite a partial lockdown in place since the beginning of November. The German government now says the lockdown will be extended that is into January. Chancellor Angela Merkel has said the measures will ease only if dramatic drop occurs in the number of infections. Football legend Diego Maradona has been laid to rest in a cemetery outside Argentina's capital of Buenos Aires. Maradona was buried in a private ceremony attended by around 24 relatives and close friends. That ceremony followed a day of emotional scenes in Buenos Aires. Huge crowds had gathered there to pay their respects to a man they considered a national hero. Maradona died of a heart attack on Wednesday at the age of 60. Argentinian President Alberto Fernandez declared 3 days of national mourning. Maradona was one of the greatest footballers of all time. He led Argentina to a World Cup triumph in 1986.
World superstar Diego Armando Maradona has died after suffering a heart attack at his home in the suburbs of Buenos Aires, Argentina. At just 60 years of age, the footballing icon has shocked the world for one last time. As news broke, mourners gathered across the world to pay their respects. Tributes poured in as the sense of loss was palpable across the globe. Argentine President Alberto Fernandez declared 3 days of national mourning. In Napoli, Italy, fans gathered outside the city's San Paolo Stadium, where Maradona captained the club's most successful period. As a tribute, the club will rename their stadium in honor of him. Champions League matches throughout Europe held a minute's silence for the superstar, who is held as one of the best, if not the best, to have ever played the game. But like very few, Maradona transcended his sport. He was a global icon loved by the people. The media couldn't get enough and followed him everywhere. Much was made of his life outside of football, as the icon struggled with addiction. But for many, that was part of his appeal. He was real and not a carefully choreographed PR exercise. He was a flawed footballing genius who managed to capture the imagination of the world. Despite his stature, his personality was enormous. He famously said, "I am Maradona, who makes goals, who makes mistakes. I can take it all. I have shoulders big enough to fight with everybody." This fighting spirit shone through in the man's politics. While the mainstream media will focus on his footballing abilities, human rights campaigners across the world know they have lost a true advocate for social justice, a staunch anti-imperialist who used his platform to challenge global powers. He ardently campaigned against the Iraq war and condemned global powers destroying Syria. In 1986, when the icon scored the infamous Hand of God against England, he said it was symbolic revenge for Britain's Falklands War against his country. When it came to the Palestinian cause, he proudly wore his support. The footballing icon was a great advocate of socialist leaders in South America and was great friends with Cuban revolutionary leader Fidel Castro. He famously described him as his second father. As fate would have it, Maradona would pass away on the same day as his revolutionary friend, only 4 years apart. The shock across the world is still raw. For many, the icon passed on far too young, but Diego Armando Maradona lived his life to the fullest. He was a small man, but stood head and shoulders above all on the football pitch and inspired millions off of it. He'll be remembered as one of the greatest ever.
Sudan's former prime minister and top opposition figure, Sadir al-Mahdi, died on Thursday after weeks of struggle with COVID-19. Al-Mahdi was the country's last democratically elected prime minister and a staunch opposition to normalization of ties with Israel.
Sudan's former premier Sadir al-Mahdi dies from the novel coronavirus at the age of 84. Al-Mahdi was Sudan's last democratically elected prime minister, who was transferred to the United Arab Emirates for treatment but succumbed to the illness nonetheless. The government declared 3 days of national mourning for his passing. Al-Mahdi was born in 1935 in the city of Omdurman and grew up during the last two decades of British imperial rule on Sudan. He became the country's prime minister in 1966, but his term did not last long as he was ousted in 1967 by a coalition of defectors. Later in 1986, Al-Mahdi was elected again as premier, but was toppled once more in 1989 by former ruler Omar al-Bashir in a military coup. The post of prime minister of Sudan was then abolished. Since his ouster, Al-Mahdi continued to lead the Ummah Party, one of the largest opposition movements during Bashir's era, and spent a period in exile, but eventually returned to Sudan in the year 2000. He threw his weight behind the mass protest movement that eventually prompted the military to overthrow the president last year. After Bashir's ouster, Al-Mahdi pushed for a transfer to civilian rule, warning of the risks of a counter-coup and calling for the powerful paramilitary rapid support forces to be integrated into the army. Al-Mahdi was also against the normalization of ties with Israel and supported the axis of resistance against the regime. In October, he slammed US President Donald Trump's announcement that Sudan would start normalizing ties with Israel. Al-Mahdi stressed that Trump's statement contradicts the Sudanese national law and contributes to the elimination of the peace process in the Middle East. He accused Trump of being racist against Muslims and described Israel as an apartheid regime. However, Sudan became the third Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in August. Al-Mahdi warned that normalizing ties with Tel Aviv will prepare the ground for the ignition of a new war.
And that's it with international news.
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
کتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you a fortnight ago, and here are ayahs 51, 52, 53, 54, and 55 of Surah Dukhan.
إن المتقين في مقام أمين في جنات وعيون يلبسون من سندس وإستبرق متقابلين كذلك وزوجناهم بحور عين يدعون فيها بكل فاكهة آمنين.
Indeed, the God-weary will be in a secure place, amid gardens and springs, dressed in fine silk and brocade, sitting face to face. So shall it be, and we shall wed them to black-eyed Huris. There, they will call for every fruit in safety. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the preceding ayahs of this surah, we said that, on Resurrection Day, the unbelief of unbelievers and the sins of unrepentant sinners take the form of intense fire, horribly burning both the adwars and inwards of those cast into hell. This punishment will be both physical and psychological, since the tyrants, who thought they were mighty, powerful, and wealthy, will have to suffer the consequences of their crimes against humanity and God, the all-merciful Creator, who never wrongs anyone, and it is only the disbelievers and intransigent sinners who wrong themselves. In contrast, the ayahs that we recited to you now depict the situation of the virtuous and God-fearing persons who are granted the bliss of paradise, saying they will be in a safe place, immune from any grief, pain, anxiety, and calamity, amid gardens and fresh flowing springs, where their garments will be of the finest fabrics of silk and brocade. They will have luxurious couches to sit upon and enjoy, in an atmosphere of friendship and amity with each other. The rewards of their faith in God and their good deeds. The men will be married to the most beautiful females called Huris, who are of delicate white complexion and endowed with lovely glowing black eyes of wide dimensions. For the people of paradise, all kinds of pure, fresh, and delicious food, fruits, and drinks will be available without any trouble. One should, however, not get the wrong impression that paradise is only for men, since God Almighty has granted a special status in heaven for the faithful and virtuous women as well. In short, these ayahs indicate both the spiritual and physical pleasures of paradise, since in the same manner that every human being is essentially composed of soul and body, the divine bounties are consistent with spirituality and corporeality. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. Serenity and security are among the most important divine bounties, and this is the reason these have been mentioned here before the other bounties of heaven, where there is no anxiety and fear or even any concern of loss and death. Number 2. What takes a person to paradise is faith in the one and only Creator of the universe, coupled with good deeds in line with obedience to His commandments, as elaborated by His messengers, that is, the prophets and the imams, who set the practical example of refraining from forbidden words and actions through leading of a virtuous life, even in the most adverse circumstances, without the least fear of evil persons and tyrants. Number 3. The eternal bliss of paradise is a place where both spiritual and corporeal pleasures gather as rewards for the true believers. And number 4. In paradise, the atmosphere of perpetual peace, amity, and friendship prevails with no trace of any negative attitudes, such as enmity, hatred, jealousy, grudge, greed, envy, or even sickness and disease. Now let us listen to ayahs 56 and 57 of this surah.
لا يذوقون فيها الموت إلا الموتة الأولى ووقاهم عذاب الجحيم فضلا من ربك ذلك هو الفوز العظيم.
There they will not taste death except the first death of the mortal world, and he will save them from the punishment of hell. This is a grace from your Lord. That is the great success. After resurrection, there will be no death, neither for those cast into the blazing fire of hell, nor for those granted the bliss of paradise. This eternity, whether in the state of severe torment for the disbelievers or in perpetual comfort for the true believers, is the result of their own beliefs and deeds. As mentioned in several places in the Noble Quran, which says that those who enter paradise will remain therein forever, safe from the fires of hell. This is indeed the grace of the all-merciful God, who grants this great success to the virtuous believers as an infinite reward for the sincerity of their good deeds, however trivial. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, those granted the bliss of paradise will remain therein forever, while from among those cast into hell, in contrast to the eternally damned disbelievers, the sinful believers not forgiven during life will be shifted to heaven after the fire had cleansed them of the gravity of their sins. Number two, God grants safety from the fire of hell to those who fulfill the divine obligations and abstain from sins, as well as to those who sincerely repent of their sins and reform themselves by seeking forgiveness from the Lord Most High. And number three, no one can claim that his or her good deeds are comparable to the great bounties granted to us by the all-merciful God, including the reward of paradise, which is indeed a divine grace. Now we listen to ayahs 58 and 59 of Surah Dukhan.
فَإِنَّمَا يَسَّرْنَاهُ بِلِسَانِكَ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَذَكَّرُونَ فَارْتَقِبْ إِنَّهُمْ مُرْتَقِبُونَ.
Indeed, we have made the Quran simple in your language so that they may take admonition. So wait. Indeed, they too are waiting. These concluding ayahs of Surah Dukhan indicate that the goal of divine revelation is to admonish mankind and awaken them from negligence. In other words, the purpose of the Noble Quran is to make human beings realize that they are the creatures of the one and only God, and therefore should not stray from the straight and unwavering path towards paradise that saves them from the pitfalls of hell. These ayahs mean to say that God Almighty sent down the Noble Quran in the Arabic language as the final heavenly scripture to all mankind, so that upon observing its flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom, they perceive that it springs from the springhead of divine emanation. Moreover, unlike scientific books that are not easy to grasp for most people and meant for specialists only, the Noble Quran is understandable to the general public, and everyone can perceive it according to his or her level of knowledge. This enables them to believe in the universal mission of the last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Prophet, for his part, expounded the meanings of these divine words, which means that those who refuse to use their God-given intellect to accept facts and realities have to await the wrath of the all-merciful Lord. The Prophet awaits the divine promise of the ultimate triumph of Islam, while the disbelievers are merely waiting in vain for their evil intentions. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the message of the Quran, though in flawless Arabic, is easy to understand, while scholars in every age and place, as per the teachings of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, explain its finer points to the public in simple language. Number two, God Almighty, by raising a long line of prophets in every age and place, along with heavenly scriptures for the guidance of humanity, has sealed his argumentation, culminating in the finality of divine revelation in the form of the Noble Quran to his last and greatest messenger, with the universal mission of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. And number three, if the intransigence of disbelievers refuse to use their God-given intellect to accept the truth, then they should await divine wrath. Dear listeners, that marks the end of Surah Dukhan, and next Friday we will embark on explanation of Surah 47 titled Al-Jathiyah. Until then, goodbye and God bless you.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. 39 Afghan civilians who were killed in 2002 are most likely to have been killed illegally by Australian Special Forces. Now, this is according to a four-year investigation by Australian Defence Force after complaints by Afghan and Australian nationals to investigate. So what does it all mean now? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
The Australian military is under fire following the release of a damning report this week that has found credible evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. The long-awaited report, based on a four-year inquiry, has found evidence that Australian Special Forces killed dozens of Afghan prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. The findings of the inquiry, carried out by the Australian Defence Force, reveal a twisted and extreme warrior culture among the elite of the Australian Armed Forces who were deployed to Afghanistan. The commandos were supposed to fight militants thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but many of them now stand accused of engaging a methodical campaign to kill unarmed Afghans and conceal it. In one instance, the inquiry has found evidence that platoon commanders told junior soldiers to get their first kill by shooting prisoners. An academic who carried out initial research into the atrocities believes that they were, quote, deliberate, repeated, and targeted war crimes. The inquiry findings show that some of the soldiers who are accused of committing these war crimes are still serving in the Australian military. The report has been highly redacted, and many details of the atrocities remain unknown. But its authors have admitted that they probably failed to uncover all crimes committed during a period of time under investigation. They have recommended a mechanism to collect and assess further allegations of atrocities in Afghanistan. The findings are deeply embarrassing for the Australian government, which is a vociferous critic of rights abuses around the world. The government initially tried to suppress whistleblowers and local media that had tried to bring the alleged war crimes to public attention. Australian authorities tried hard to keep a lid on this story when it first emerged in 2017. That year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation published shocking allegations of unlawful killings of unarmed Afghans, including children, based on leaked military documents. The Australian Federal Police raided the office of the national broadcaster and tried in vain to prosecute the journalist who blew the whistle on the killings. The story now seems to have turned into a major scandal. The latest findings are a painful legacy of America's longest war. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 has resulted in nearly two decades of war. A very large number of Afghan civilians, including children, have lost their lives in American and U.S.-led airstrikes and operations. The U.S.-led military campaign has failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with an endless list of problems. The United States itself is being investigated for possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The ICC probe began earlier this year after a preliminary report found reasons to believe war crimes had been committed during the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who was infuriated by the investigation, imposed sanctions on the court. His decision drew worldwide condemnation. Observers believe that the U.S. must have a lot to worry about as the International Criminal Court investigates its actions during the war in Afghanistan.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London and journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start off in London with Jonathan. What did you think about the findings of this investigation, and were you surprised at all that these type of abuses had taken place?
Obviously, the reports are very shocking indeed, even though it was somewhat redacted. There's enough information in there to really raise huge questions over the whole nature of the operations of the special forces of the Australian Army in Afghanistan. The good thing is the report has come out, and also that the head of the Defence Services has apologised. But of course, an apology is nothing like enough. There will be prosecutions, and that must be prosecutions. But it shouldn't only be the younger soldiers who end up being prosecuted, because I think clearly the command chain goes higher, including perhaps into the political sphere of the leadership in Australia. And there needs to be a very, very careful investigation as to exactly how this sort of policy came about, where, as was mentioned in the introductory piece, for example, there would be what was called blooding. Young recruits just arriving would be told to shoot the prisoner in order to get them used to killing civilians, which is clearly a war crime.
Well, Brett, in the report it states about that war culture that our guest in London just was mentioning amongst these elite troops, and the way some troops were anxious to get their first kill. And what exactly does that say? I mean, does it appear to you that this would just be something isolated and these troops were not following orders? Do you think this is just isolated with these individuals, or do you think that the responsibility goes further up the ladder?
I think it definitely runs further than just the rank-and-file troops that have committed these atrocities. Indeed, as has been mentioned and as was written in the report, in many cases, these were initiation rituals of a kind. You know, young soldiers, grunts who come into combat for the first time, who are being told to basically get their hands dirty immediately in one of the most gruesome ways possible by murdering either civilians or unarmed prisoners. And, of course, this order had to come from someone. And so this order came most likely from the officers. And the officer staff, of course, responds to an even higher brass of higher officers and higher-ups, that I think it's very unlikely, if this was such a relatively commonplace occurrence, as seems to be hinted in the report, it would be very unlikely that the higher brass did not know about this, and that the military leadership was in the dark about this. I think this is, on the contrary, this speaks to a very typical and very problematic culture of extreme nationalism and jingoism in not just Australia, and not Australia in particular even, but in the Western armed forces that have been active in the Middle East in general and in Central Asia in the past few decades. This is a very this is a typical sort of mentality that you see also expressed in the United States military, I believe also in the British military, and in many of the troops that and armies in general, army command structures of the nations that are active in the conflict in, for example, Afghanistan, but also in Iraq. Because what you see is a form of result, what I would call a result of decades of massive propaganda, of dehumanization of the enemy, and not just of the enemy, but of the people living in the country. Mm-hmm. This is no longer crimes committed against people who fought necessarily against this these troops. These are not just Taliban soldiers or Daesh or whatever extremists that are being targeted. These are very often civilians. There have been numerous cases of footage being published in which soldiers, usually American soldiers, are traveling through the countryside in Afghanistan and just murder some farmers or some goat herders or shepherds along the way, because they know that there is very little chance of this really going viral, let's say, because they, for them, these are just illiterate peasants that they mm-hmm. can do with whatever they want. This is a problem of mentality, a problem of mindset
okay.
that's all pervasive in the military structure of many Western societies.
What about that, Jonathan? I mean, do you think in general this U.S.-led coalition, and in this case we're talking about the Australian side of things, but in general that, as our other guest was alluding to, that they have this superiority type of attitude when dealing with the other, especially, for example, dealing with Afghans, and basically not even looking at these people as human sometimes?
Yes, I'm sure that's right. Brett is absolutely correct to focus on the dehumanization of the other in these sorts of conflict situations. The fact that they're of different ethnicity, the fact that they are Muslims in most cases, also plays into this narrative of some countries, including the United States, that see them therefore as the enemy, whether they are actually armed resistance or terrorists or just ordinary farmers going about their own business. And there seems to have been such an acceptance of that situation in Afghanistan, by no means only by the Australians, that poor Afghans who were confronted with these sorts of situations often didn't even complain because they thought it would be a complete waste of time, that there was a culture of impunity, and well-armed Westerners, whether they were Australians, Americans, or indeed British, would always be able to have their way, and that the best way to escape problems was to remain quiet and out of sight. So there is a real problem, but it's not only in Afghanistan. We saw incidents like that in Iraq as well. For example, the way that Americans treated people in Abu Ghraib prison, you may recall, appalling scenes of degradation and dehumanization. And this is something that really Western countries, including Britain, have got to come to terms with and to stamp out.
Well, Brett, the acts that, actually crimes that we're talking about happened 18 years ago. Why do you think it's taken so long to expose this when Afghan families have been complaining from the very beginning about the abuses of U.S.-led coalition forces there?
Well, I think it's a combination of general problems, of course, getting information like this out to the world, but combined with a far more important and far more destructive problem, being the policy of keeping a lid on everything. As has been said in the beginning of the report, indeed, by the reporter on the scene, is that when ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, reported on this in 2017 in the first place, their offices were raided, and the journalist was for a while threatened basically to be treated as, for example, Julian Assange or Edward Snowden were when they basically blew a whistle on certain crimes that were being committed in the country or by people of the country's nationality. So this is, when you see that this is how far they will go in broad daylight in Australia already, you can only begin to imagine how far they will go in order to keep this under, to swipe this under the rug when it's being said in Afghanistan. You can imagine if a a farmer or a shepherd in Afghanistan goes to complain to the authorities, to the police forces, even if it's the Afghan local authorities, the chances are very high, of course, that this complaint will be noticed by the occupying forces, the foreign forces that are being talked about, in this case, the Australians. So, of course, there is no evidence of a violent crackdown on people who are trying to explain their story. But I don't think it would be very far-fetched to believe that these people are likely threatened with violence, threatened with more dangerous acts if mm-hmm. they try to get their story known. And indeed, as Mr. Fryer said, the problem is that many of these people, after a while, probably just gave up trying to complain about it in general, because what's the point of trying to get your story out if you know the lid will be trying to, they will try to put the lid on it
okay.
constantly. And that result is that, fortunately, we have had some good journalists now, Australian journalists who have finally decided to publish the story. But it will, of course, it has taken years for these people to dig through the mud in order to get what they needed in order to publish this report. That's the result of it.
Right. And Jonathan, at the end of the day, do you think that any measures will really be taken against these soldiers? Will these soldiers be charged with murder, you think?
Well, I think certainly there will be prosecutions. Whether they will be found guilty and sentenced to long periods of prison is another matter. But I think there certainly will be prosecutions. It would be very difficult for the Australian government to avoid putting some troops on trial because of the public opinion and international opinion, which would demand that some people have to bear responsibility. As I mentioned earlier, the problem is how high up the line should this go? Because obviously the higher it goes, then the less likelihood there is of any proper retribution against the people who are responsible for the policy, which does stem into the whole of the war on terror narrative. In other words, that if you're in a situation where you're dealing against with terrorists, that anything goes, and that means that ordinary civilians who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with any extreme group get caught up in this. So I think it's very important for international law that Australia takes a stand, and that other countries, including Britain, also look at their own special forces and really see whether this problem is wider and whether how it can be rooted out.
Well, Brett, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison now has apologized directly to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani about what he called these abuses. But what does that mean at the end of the day? What do you think is going to happen?
Of course, the problem is that it's very easy to apologize for something that happened. The question here is, of course, if you not just, you know, talk the talk, but also walk the walk. And that's something that Australia has to prove now. They have to show to the world that they take this seriously, that these people will be tried for the crimes that they have committed. And indeed, this in many cases, this would definitely include the charge of murder or at least manslaughter, and not just, you know, crimes that, not just like abuses that were committed in the time of war. Because that makes it sound like there are circumstances that would justify these actions. And I don't think these things are justifiable, no matter under which circumstances they happen. The other problem, of course, is the question remains how far Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, will go in order to pursue this. Because we have seen time and again that the Afghan government is not always necessarily a stable government, and is in many cases and in many ways very dependent, of course, on these foreign troops that are keeping it in power. There is very often a problem of popular support that is very much lacking popular support for this government. And as a result, it is very difficult, I think, for the it is very unlikely, I mean, to hope that these Afghan politicians will really try to pressure what they perceive as their Western allies into really pursuing this very much. Of course, I could be mistaken, and I hope I will be. But this goes much further than just apologizing and saying sorry that this happened. These people have to be brought to justice. Recompensation should be paid to the families of the victims. And in general, actually, recompensation should be paid to Afghanistan, because this is running into their hundreds of billions of dollars that Afghanistan has been suffering in both economic terms and, of course, in manpower and in population, a lot of people that have been massacred as a result of this unnecessary war ever since 2001. Mm-hmm. So this is a general problem that has to be solved in a way that is much more fundamental. And that is something in which I fear that is unlikely to happen, because if we bring it back to the leader of this coalition, the United States, we have to bear in mind the United States has never even recompensated Vietnam for the crimes they have committed there 40, 50 years ago. So right. the chances that they could do this anytime soon to Afghanistan are, I'm afraid, quite slim.
Well, Jonathan, are there double standards in the way U.S. allies are held responsible for war crimes as opposed to those fighting against the U.S.?
Well, I mean, a war crime is a war crime, whoever carries it out, whether it's the U.S. or any of their allied forces in a country like Afghanistan, or any extremist group. In the news bulletin, you mentioned today's attacks from Daesh on Kabul again, yet more civilians killed in that attack. And certainly, they need to be held to account as well, but it's much more difficult because, of course, you can't often identify where is the chain of command and who are really carrying out these atrocities. But the whole idea of setting up the International Criminal Court several years ago, which Trump so dislikes, is the idea that there are international standards, and these should apply to governments, to armies, and to non-state actors. And it's very important, I think, that this principle be bolstered by appropriate judicial action, and that the climate of impunity in a war situation is removed, because surely in the 21st century we should have realized that it's no longer possible to justify many things which perhaps our ancestors considered perfectly normal, but which we don't.
What do you think about that, Brett? The things that ancestors didn't consider normal, but which we don't. However, if we look at the world of 2020 and we see the imbalance of it all, how much have we progressed? When we look at this situation, at the end of the day, don't you think, according to international standards, that the life of an Afghan is not going to be held the same as for as an American soldier being killed, or an Aussie soldier being killed, or a Brit being killed on the ground? Isn't there a difference when we see terrorist attacks and how we react when they're committed in Afghanistan as opposed to a terrorist attack in Europe or some of these other Western countries?
Yeah, this is, I believe that is undeniably true. There is a massive amount of hypocrisy in general, in international media, mainstream media mostly, in international politics, even in international diplomacy. There is a massive issue that we have seen over and over again, that when a terrorist attack happens, for example, in Brussels or in Paris, this is worldwide news. This goes on to dominate world politics for years sometimes. Whereas these sort of attacks that have been taking place, for example, in Paris, they happen on a weekly basis in some areas in the Middle East, for example, and in many cases those same sort of attacks of that magnitude are being committed by the Western powers that are mourning the attacks that are taking place in the West. Now, the problem is that there is this massive double standard that unfortunately has seeped very much into the ICC as well. The ICC has been doing some good work ever since it was founded, undeniably so. But there is an undeniable focus on certain third world leaders of certain third world countries. There is a reason why in some regions of Africa, the ICC is jokingly called the International Caucasian Court, because it's something that it's a court that is perceived as a very Eurocentric court that specifically targets leaders of in Africa mostly, or in Yugoslavia, be leaders of third world countries, of countries that are not part of the hegemonic powers, and that these people, for their crimes or perceived crimes, are being dragged to The Hague in order to be tried. But it's very almost unheard of to see this pressure, the same sort of status, the same sort of rules being applied to people and rulers of first world countries. For example, you know, George W. Bush. For example, the crimes committed by President Obama, who even received the Nobel Peace Prize. right before he went on to, you know, murder people in